The book of Leviticus was the first book Jewish children learned in the synagogue. Does that surprise you? Because it did surprise me. Leviticus emphasizes holiness of life and talks about how its readers are to approach God. These emphases made Leviticus a really good starting point for children, a very practical book full of things about living set apart. But in the minds of modern Bible readers, Leviticus does not normally occupy a central place at all. In fact, Leviticus has a reputation that precedes it, and it's not good. There are difficulties in the book. We want to acknowledge this. There are some bizarre instructions, some strange laws, and the details about the sacrificial system may feel very far removed from us. We don't offer what they did at a tabernacle. And so the experience of those first readers is so far removed from ours these millennia later and post-Christ, and we don't practice these and can feel a remoteness, even a altogether irrelevance of the book. So while Leviticus was a primary book for children in the Jewish synagogue, it is a low on the totem pole spot for Christians most of the time, I'm afraid. We have underestimated the role of this book in both the Old and New Testaments. Its instructions and warnings are foundational for all the Old Testament books which follow it. There are also teachings in Leviticus which will illuminate the Gospels, the ministry of Christ, his miracles. It will illuminate parts of the book of Acts, statements in the New Testament letters, and the book of Revelation. All of the New Testament, we are helped in understanding by looking at Leviticus. The New Testament letter to the Hebrews is a major example. Hebrews is saturated with themes and ideas from Leviticus. It's in order to show the value of Christ's death upon the cross, and of all the Old Testament books, the writer will again turn to the book of Leviticus for it. He wants you to understand the death of Christ's, not just the value, but its surpassing fulfillment at the cross. Leviticus is a great place to go because of its sacrificial offerings and instructions. The writer of Hebrews expects you to know the book of Leviticus. Author Dane Ortlund recently said, "Leviticus is the Old Testament Hebrews, and Hebrews is the New Testament Leviticus." And I think that's a really good way to think about it, because it shows the organic connection between these two books by the Spirit of God. A reader might look at the title of the book and automatically feel that it's very narrow, because the word Levite is in the word Leviticus. The word Leviticus means pertaining to the Levites, and we know that they were a tribe from which the priests came. So the idea might be that Leviticus just applies to those priests. But most of Leviticus, actually, is for the Israelites in general and not the priests most specifically. They do have attention given to them. The word Leviticus was added after the Old Testament period and before the New Testament period. So during the intertestamental period, the title Leviticus, though added because there are some things pertaining to Levites, might not be the most accurate title for the book. In fact, Old Testament Jews would typically refer to the book by its opening words. One writer said that a more fitting title for Leviticus would be "How to Live as the Holy Priestly Kingdom of the Heavenly King." Now, that's like a Puritan title, okay? That's really long. But at the same time, that gets at the beauty and grandeur of this book. I'm afraid that in many cases, the very title Leviticus seems almost inaccessible. Leviticus is almost entirely the speech of God. There are some brief narrations of events. Most of it is God talking to Moses, telling him, "Say this to the Israelites." There's very little narration. But the setting for the whole book is at one place, at Mount Sinai. In Genesis, there's a lot of moving around. In Exodus, there's a lot of moving around. In Leviticus, nobody leaves Mount Sinai. The whole book is in one spot. And we can even identify the amount of weeks that would be at least comprising these chapters. We know that at the end of Exodus, they set up the tabernacle on the first month of their second year. And they depart from Sinai in Numbers chapter 10 in the second month of their second year. So Leviticus is about a month-long period of time. Instructions are being given, instructions are being conveyed, but these 27 chapters are about that in-between month. That in-between month where the tabernacle has been set up, glory has filled it, but the Israelites have not departed yet. So that 1 month has a lot of important activity and instruction, mainly instruction. Now, when we think about the outline of the book, I have behind me a way to try to wrap our mind around what we are looking at. The first seven chapters of Leviticus are all about offerings at the tabernacle. Chapters 8 to 10 are about the priesthood, including the famous and sudden deaths of Nadab and Abihu. We also see in chapters 11 through 15 instructions about dealing with impurity or uncleanness. But chapter 16, it deserves a spot all its own. Chapter 16 is the instruction about the Day of Atonement. This chapter is the center of gravity for the whole book. And the rest of the book, chapter 17 to 27, is about living a life of holiness and love before God. All kinds of instructions about how to live before God and with others in the most holy and related way that would honor the Lord and dignify his image bearers. This breakdown behind me is a way of trying to get at what these 27 chapters are about. Even though I have separated chapter 16 into what maybe it's the fourth slot there, when you look at the word count of the book, chapter 16 is actually about the center of the book. And this is significant because of its content. It's not just any set of instructions. It's the set of instructions about the Day of Atonement. So if there is a literary centralizing of that chapter, that's interesting. It's as if everything before the Day of Atonement chapter is building up to that, and that everything after the Day of Atonement chapter is leading out from that. Consider chapter 16 the summit of the book. Now, the Israelites had foundational for all of their instruction the Torah, or the Pentateuch, which were the first five books of the Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The central book is Leviticus. It has Genesis and Exodus before that, where they are arriving at Sinai in Exodus. And then Numbers following, they are leaving Sinai and heading to the promised land that was promised in Genesis. Leviticus is the only book of the Torah that takes place at Mount Sinai entirely, and it is the shortest of the five, but it's in the central spot. And so one Old Testament scholar observed this. Notice that the book in the middle is Leviticus, and that the central concept in the book of Leviticus is the Day of Atonement. He said if we were to zoom out at the Pentateuch or Genesis through Deuteronomy, the center of gravity in the whole Torah is the instruction about the Day of Atonement for Israel. That's a major significant thing right there in the book. Therefore, the structure matters because of what it's leading to and leading from, the summit being chapter 16. The book of Leviticus is trying to answer questions like, how do we approach God? How do we live before God in a way that's holy and in a way with others that is loving and dignifying to their status as image bearers? And so the first seven chapters of Leviticus will be our first few messages together. We'll take an entire chapter tonight, and we're looking at these laws about major offerings for Israel. The tabernacle had just been completed. The glory of God has filled it. But here's what we notice from Exodus 40. Moses could not yet enter the tabernacle. God had designated Aaron and his sons as priests. And so if the tabernacle was to be a place of worship, and they were to approach this God whose glory had filled it, how are they going to approach? Leviticus is the sequel to Exodus. And so Leviticus is answering the question prompted by the end of Exodus 40. Leviticus begins with a bunch of offerings so that when you look at the end of Exodus and here's this glorious tabernacle and you wonder, how can we approach God? Leviticus opens with saying, by sacrifice. That's how you will approach him. And so the very placement of these chapters is theologically significant because it's telling us this God who's now come to dwell in our midst welcomes sinners to come to him through a substitute. These seven chapters matter, and these seven chapters cover five offerings. The first tonight, the burnt offering, as it's often called, or the ascension offering. Might go by either of those names in your translation heading. Mine calls it laws for burnt offerings. Same idea. And so in verses 1 and 2, what we're going to see tonight to outline our chapter is instructions to Moses for Israel. And what he's going to tell them involves the burnt offering sacrifice. And they have multiple options for the animals they could offer. They could take an offering from the herd, Those are the first chunk of verses. They could take an offering from a flock. That's the second chunk of verses. Or they could take an animal from the birds. That's the last chunk. All of this is under the heading, the burnt offerings. And the reason somebody might opt for a flock or a bird has to do with economic and financial well-being. An animal from the herd was the most expensive and came at the greatest economic cost to the owner. More frequently, animals from flocks were given, and for the poor of the land, who were still to be included in the bringing of offerings to the Lord, they were permitted to bring one of two birds. Okay, so the way this chapter is outlined has to do with walking through what if you bring this offering, and what if you bring this animal, and what if you bring this animal, all under the big heading of this burnt or ascension offering. So let's look at these first two verses where the instructions to Moses are given. The Lord called Moses. Now, my translation, maybe yours as well, omits a word. The word and or then. And the Lord called Moses, or then the Lord called Moses. Now, why does that matter? Because this is not the beginning of the story. Genesis was the beginning of the story. And Exodus begins with a conjunction, transitioning from Genesis into Exodus. And Leviticus transitions from the end of Exodus into this chapter. So yes, the Lord called Moses. But let's remember that even in the original language, it is clear we are continuing where we just left off. So we are primed and ready to study the book of Leviticus because we have seen the glories and wonders of the book of Exodus in these recent months. Leviticus is almost entirely the record of God's speech. So when it says the Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, most of what Leviticus will contain are words of God to Moses at Mount Sinai. And not only are they at Mount Sinai, most specifically, the speech is from this tent of meeting that's been set up at the end of the book. The tent of meeting, you guys remember what that was? It was this thing. The tent of meeting. You've seen that diagram. It's been a while. I know you missed it. It's back. Okay, so it's behind me here. And they entered into the east. And the tabernacle, or the tent of meeting, is that major construction that's west of that bronze altar and water basin. And that tabernacle was a place where only priests could go, and in the most inner room, you had only a place the high priest could go on the Day of Atonement. Now, that's Leviticus 16. That's still a ways away. But in verses 1 and 2, God has words for Moses, and it is his glory-filled presence in this tent of meeting that's now going to proclaim these instructions. This is probably Moses inside the tabernacle, but not behind the veil, separated from God, but nonetheless the glory and presence of God there with the people of God communicating to them through Moses. Moses, in other words, is their mediator once more. Just like in Exodus, they said, you go up to Mount Sinai, and the glory of God will descend there, and you speak to God, and you come tell us what he said. The tabernacle has become a portable Mount Sinai. Because earlier in the Mount Sinai episodes, the glory of God would descend, and God would speak to Moses. Here, the glory descends upon the tabernacle. And now, wherever that tabernacle goes, the glorious presence of God is there, communicating to his people through the mediator Moses. In verse 2, he says, speak to the people of Israel, and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock, or from the herd, or from the flock. We'll see a bird option added as well. These are words for all the people of God. He says in verse 2, when any one of you, this is not meant to particularize a certain tribe, or a certain age, or a certain gender. The whole of the people of God need to know what Moses is hearing here. The instructions are for them. And in chapters 1 through 7 of Leviticus, you see a variety of offerings that begin here with the burnt offering. This is a set of laws focusing on this ascension or burnt offering, beginning with the offering from the herd. And so back to this example here, we move to verses 3 to 9, this example of an outline where we see an offering from the herd. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. The burnt offering is at the very beginning of the set of offerings in these seven chapters. The reason the burnt offering is first is it was the most frequently given. The priests would offer one for the nation every morning and every evening. And these instructions allow voluntary offerings from the individual Israelites to come as well. This was the most frequently given of the offerings. And it's important because the burnt offering is entirely devoted to the Lord. There are other offerings that are shared by the priests in terms of some of the food. Other times there might be an offering shared by the offerer as well. But in this case, this offering, not the priest's share of, nor the offerer, but all of it completely consumed and devoted to God. That is why it is called the whole burnt offering, or an ascension offering, that it rises to God alone. It implies that the offering, which was an animal originally, is burned until it's all smoke and ash, and the ashes are kept and then deposited outside the camp, and the rest of it is smoke unto God. The burnt offering communicates that the wages of sin is death. That is Romans looking at the Levitical offering and tying together what is it that we see when people are bringing in this animal, slitting its throat, and burning it before God. The lesson is the wages of sin is death. And the Israelites were to know this. The Israelites were to know, I am blemished. I am spiritually, morally blemished. So what I need is to be unblemished, but I can't be. So I'm offering what's required here as a male without blemish. Without blemish. This is to communicate what ought to be true morally for the offerer, but unfortunately isn't. There's probably a couple reasons scholars suggest for why it's a male offering. Number one, males were eaten because they were less valuable than the female breeding stock. You can imagine a male that could impregnate multiple females. And so if you had females that were offered instead, that might drastically decrease the amount that could be bred. But secondly, the male was also the head of the herd or the flock. And so if it's representing the fact that these tribes were to be leading Israel and the heads of those homes being the husbands and the fathers, then perhaps a male animal was communicating that as well. I don't even think we have to choose between those options. They may both have validity. But the offering without blemish, that seems to be a really important point. What blemishes were forbidden? Leviticus 22, verse 22 says, animals that are blind or disabled or mutilated or having a discharge or an itch or scabs, you shall not offer to Yahweh or give them to the Lord as a food offering. Those are all examples of blemishes from Leviticus 22, 22. So an unblemished animal, I think, is required for two reasons: what it says about God and what it says about us. First, an unblemished animal is a statement about God's worth. It's saying God deserves what is pure and right and worthy, if you will, as much as it could be said of an animal. But it says something also about us, because we are not unblemished. We have moral failure and sin. We have a corrupt nature. So because I'm spiritually blemished, I must offer an unblemished substitute. It's an offering that highlights a spiritual truth. What we're told in verse 3 is that he shall offer a male without blemish and bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that it may be accepted before the Lord. I think this means that he comes into this eastern entrance and he's got the animal with him. But what do you see when you first come into the courtyard? You see an altar. Before you even get to the tabernacle proper, you have this symbol of sacrifice, because there is no approaching a holy God when we are unholy, apart from sacrifice. And so the placement of the bronze altar where it is incredibly significant by its theological and spiritual truth that it underlines. And so they come into the entrance here, and they're ready to present it. This may be a declaration that we're coming to bring this particular offering or some sort of prayer, but the presentation, it probably invokes some kind of words that are just aren't reported here. Now, the goal of the offering, notice in verse 3, he shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. This suggests that the Israelites are to understand, we need peace with God, and I'm going to substitute something that God is going to look on, and that I am able to dwell at peace with him. Something is offered in my place. So the goal of the offering is that the offerer may be accepted before Yahweh. Peace with God is the goal of sacrifice. And God is holy, and I am unholy. He's an unblemished creator and redeemer, and I am a blemished image bearer. And so sacrifice is the way peaceful coexistence happens between a holy God and unholy people, lest he break out in glory and absolutely consume in his justice the sinners that are there. This offering is known as the ascension offering because as it is burned, the smoke goes to God and all of the animal is to be consumed. Ascension is an important word because later in Jerusalem, for instance, thinking about what happens under Solomon, he builds the temple in Jerusalem. Pilgrims would ascend to Jerusalem. They would ascend to the temple. They would bring an ascension offering. There's a lot of movement up. And when the smoke is released, it's this picture of going up and being received by God. Because it's our desire to go to God. It's our desire to ascend, if you will, into his presence. It's our desire to be a part of that. So it's as if that smoke and animal is representing us so that I am received by the Lord. It's as if I am ascending into his presence through the substitute. And in verse 4, he, the offerer, shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Verse 4, lay his hand. Your translation might say something like lay. Better is the word lean or press on. So what this involves is I'm not just bringing this animal. The animal is alive, and I am bringing it to the priest, and I'm visually doing something which somebody would notice. It's just like if you had your hand out and you were resting against a cabinet or a table behind you. You're looking at this animal, and your hand is not just touching its head as if you're like petting it. Okay? You don't know what's coming for you, you know? Just you're petting, you're instead, I know, they didn't, had no clue. They would lean their hand and press on the head of the animal. They're not touching the back of the animal or its foot or its, they're touching the head of the animal and they're leaning on it. This is this visual act communicates identification of the offerer with the sacrifice. Because if this sacrifice is received by God, what this is indicating is that I'm received by God and I'm blemished. So what I need is this unblemished offering to be received by the Lord in a way that honors his law and reflects his worth and glory. And so in verse 4, I'm going to read the word this way, he shall lean his hand on the head of the burnt offering and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. One writer put it this way, sin and guilt lie heavily upon us, leans and presses upon us. So it's as if I am symbolically communicating a transfer, that what I deserve being death and judgment, I am leaning on and pressing on this animal so that what I deserve is put upon its head, and then it will die in my place that I may be brought in before God. We see the gospel all over this, and we're four verses into Leviticus. This is why Dane Ortlund said that Leviticus is like the Old Testament book of Hebrews, and that Hebrews is like the New Testament Leviticus. I mean, the sufficiency and glory of Christ's sacrifice is all wrapped up in here in anticipating tones in a way that's wonderful. In verse 5, then he shall kill the bull before the Lord. Now, an animal from the herd was probably a bull or a calf. That's probably what's in view here. And here a bull is named. In verse 5, he shall kill the bull before the Lord, he still being the offerer. I want you to think about what a intimate, participatory, involved, messy act this was. Okay? So I want you to think about the fact that you're bringing in this animal, your hand is upon its head, and then you're killing it. You're killing it. And slaying or killing the bull probably involved the slicing of the throat. And then Aaron's sons are ready. What are they ready at? They're ready at this altar right here, this bronze altar. We'll zoom in. Boom, there you go. Here's the zoomed in picture. This is the altar that they're ready at. And they've got all these pots and vessels and bowls. And they're ready so that when the throat is slit, they're going to gather some blood. Now follow carefully what happens next. They shall bring the blood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that's at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Throwing the blood. So they've gathered it and they are tossing it on the sides of the altar because the animal on the altar and the smoke coming up from the altar is representing what's being given to God. So this is a way of communicating that this is the blood that was shed for the life of the offerer. And so this blood is applied to the sides of the altar, which is the place of sacrifice. We were told in the book of Hebrews, leaning on the Old Testament for this as well, that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. This lesson is communicated in the sacrificial system and in the first of these offerings, the burnt offering. And so the priest gives the animal's lifeblood, puts it against with the other sides of the altar as well, puts the blood all around it, throwing it perhaps from the basin. Then in verse 6, he, probably still the offerer, shall flay or skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. So just in case you thought you were done with your responsibilities, you're not done. You now are going to remove the skin and outside of the animal and slice it into pieces as if you're preparing a meal. And besides, a bull would not necessarily be a small animal. It's not like you're just going to pick that bad boy up, you know, and just toss that on the top. I mean, this is a big altar, 7.5 feet square, about 4.5 feet off the ground. So it can hold the girth of this animal, but you're going to cut it up into pieces and it's going to be placed on there. So in verse 6, he, the offerer, shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. Now, it's very likely that he may have had some help here. Most Old Testament scholars are comfortable with the idea that the offerer may have had the assistance of priests who, in their own offering of the morning and evening offerings, the burnt offerings, would be very accustomed to performing this act. They would be professional skinners, right? I mean, they're just getting this, and they're probably quick, and they are cutting it up. And so in verse 7, the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. So this is a picture of the wood and the fire already arranged. And that priest there that's got that instrument in his hand, this is a set of tongs or some sort of instrument or fork instrument that's going to be moving around the pieces in order for it to be above the fire, or at least the hottest part, in order to catch fire and become holy smoke. So this offering is transformed. It's no longer an animal by the time this is done. It becomes ash and smoke. And the ashes are going to be gathered, as you'll see in just a moment. So what are the priests arranging? Well, in verse 8, they're arranging the pieces, the head and the fat, on the wood that's on the fire on the altar. So arranging the pieces, that means the head's been severed, and then you've got all the other pieces that are going to be up there. And then in verse 9, just in case you thought you were done with your responsibility, you're not done yet. Here comes the last part. In verse 9, but its entrails and its legs, he, likely still the offerer, shall wash with water. Because while you have skinned and while you have cut up the animal, there are parts of the animal that are naturally considered unclean. Its entrails, because its intestines would have fecal matter, and its feet would be, and hooves especially, constantly trampling into unclean things. And so you're not just going to put that on the altar. You're going to clean it. And so as the animal is opened, you are going to wash its entrails and legs with water, and then the priest shall burn all of it on the altar. So the priest handles the items on the altar, but you have helped to prepare it the whole way through. You have brought it, you have slit its throat, you have skinned it, you have cut it up, you have washed its guts and feet. And now your part is done. And it's a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. That's a way of saying Yahweh delights in the result here. Not because he particularly likes the slaying of this animal. It's because these people are seeking to dwell peacefully with their holy God and honoring him by delighting in his law and following his instructions. And when Yahweh sees what has taken place here, it is like a pleasing aroma. It's like when you walk into a home and you're looking forward to some particular meal and the smell of it is just glorious. You might think this burnt offering here, that probably didn't smell good. The point wasn't the full actual literal smell of this burnt animal. The point was what it was symbolizing, namely the heart of the worshiper before God, and it pleased the Lord. And in that way, the aroma is pleasing. So let's summarize what we've got here. In verses 3 to 9, here are the tasks of the parties involved. Okay, the offerer, what's he doing? He's presenting the animal. He's laying his right hand on it, pressing, leaning. He's slaughtering the animal, or at least cutting its throat at the very minimum. He's skinning it, he's cutting it into pieces, and he's washing it. Those are six aspects of involvement that you would have. But then the priests, they're gathering blood, likely in some kind of bowl or basin. They're then throwing the blood on the sides of the altar. They're preparing the fire. They're arranging the wood. Then they're putting the parts of the animal on. And then they are ensuring to burn the entire animal. These steps or aspects of the two parties are a pattern that you're going to see unfolding in what we'll go through next. In verses 10 through 13, you see an offering from the flock. So earlier, from the herd, you might have had, especially the wealthiest of the Israelites, they might bring a calf or a bull. From the flock, you would have something like maybe a flock of goats, you would bring a goat. Maybe a flock of sheep, you would bring a sheep. And so here in verse 10, if his gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from the sheep or goats, he shall bring a male without blemish. Notice what's repeated here. The male without blemish. Because the point is not the financial status of the Israelite. The point is, no matter what their bank account looks like, they are sinful before God. So whether they could afford the bull or whether they've got to bring the sheep, which is the most common offering given before God, they are blemished and they need an unblemished animal in their place. Same requirement as that herd animal, right? In verse 11, he shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord. Well, so the north side would be this side up here, since the east entrance would take us up. The north side, the animal is to be slain. It's not clear why the north side, maybe some practical reasons. We know that the west side is where you had the basin, and the east side is where ashes were going to be. And so maybe people were standing here, and the north side was the best place to kill the animal. So there, it could just be a practical purpose. It may not mean much more than that. But in verse 11, it tells us, he shall kill it before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall throw its blood against the sides of the altar. So you know what they're doing? They're ready again with their bowl or basin. They're getting the blood, and they're putting it against the sides of the altar once more. The killing of the animal is reported by the offerer. And then, in verse 12, he shall cut it into pieces with its head and its fat. And so we have sliced its throat, and we are probably implying the skinning part, since this would be some kind of goat or sheep, and therefore skin that would need to be skinned, a hide that would need to be skinned. And so in verse 12, he then cuts it into pieces with its head and its fat, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood that's on the fire on the altar. In verse 13, but the entrails and the legs he shall wash with water. Okay, now that's very reminiscent of that herd animal, right? So here you have an animal from the flock, and its guts are going to be uncleaned, especially with the things that are in those intestines, as well as its feet that have been walking through only God knows what, right? And so then you have this responsibility then to offer what is clean and unblemished before the Lord. And that means even if the animal looks in good physical condition, you have to make sure that any contamination is dealt with. You will wash it with water. And then in verse 13, the priest shall offer all of it and burn it on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And so that takes us through verse 13. What we've looked at is under the big heading of the first burnt offering, you might offer it from the herd, like a bull or a calf. You might offer something from the flock, like a goat or a sheep. But then in verses 14 to 17, you might offer a bird. In verse 14, if his offering to Yahweh is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or pigeons. And so you were permitted to bring a dove or a young pigeon as an acceptable sacrifice for this third option. Now, you still have steps required for you, even though there's going to be a little bit of deviation here. And because of what we've seen with these previous steps, I think the deviation from some of them may be the size of the offering. So just consider the following steps in light of what we've just seen. Maybe we can detect some deviation from the pattern. In verse 14, if his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or pigeons. That means he's bringing it to the courtyard, he's coming to the entrance, he's coming up to these priests. But in verse 15, the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head. And I think that means what it sounds like, just to turn the head off and then burn it on the altar, the head that is. Its blood shall be drained out on the side of the altar. So the priest has a much more direct role here. What you don't see is this basin, perhaps, that's catching a bunch of blood and thrown against all the sides of the altar. And that's probably because there's just not enough blood in the bird. I think the size of it compared to a sheep or compared to a bull would likely explain why the blood is simply drained on the side. But notice, blood is still applied to the side of the altar because that's still important. It's the life of this animal that's being shown symbolically as a substitute for the offerer. So even if it's a small bird, it doesn't matter if it's a bull or a dove, blood has to be applied to the altar in order for the truth to be communicated of the offerer's heart before God being substituted by this animal death. And in verse 15, its blood shall be drained on the side of the altar. In verse 16, he, the offerer, shall remove its crop with its contents. Now, the crop here, I was doing some reading about this afternoon because I don't know a lot about birds. And I was reading that some birds have something called a crop, which is a pouch near the top of their neck. It's associated with their throat, and it can be connected to their digestive tract. And so there could be unclean things present there. And so what the person does is, even though the head has now been removed, what's below the head is still there. And so that part is taken out. I know some of you are squeamish. You're looking at me with the squeamish faces. So, you know, this is still the Bible. I can't do anything about it. It says what it says. And then in verse 15, it says the blood's drained. And then verse 16, the crop is removed with its contents. But then it's cast to the side on the east side of the altar, in the place for ashes. And so this is a place where things would be gathered throughout the day and then taken outside the camp at a later point. And so it's going to be placed on the east side of the altar, right there. Close to the door. And then in verse 17, he shall tear it open by its wings, which means located near its wings. He's going to begin to open the bird, but he's not going to pull the bird in half, okay? So even though he's starting to open up the bird, and even though its uncleanness has been removed, this is not a total severing of the animal. This is different, because earlier, didn't we see that you were cutting up the animal? That's not happening here. The bird, at least its body, looks together. Not like it once was, right? But it's still together. And the priest shall burn it on the altar. One of the reasons it's probably not cut up is, again, because of its size. A large sheep or a large bull, cutting those animals up made sense. But here, it's just a little bird. And so it's easily placed upon the altar to be consumed by the fire. It tells us the priest shall burn it on the altar, on the wood that's on the fire. It is a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Now, these three categories of animals, from the herd, from the flock, from birds, were all foreshadowed in the book of Genesis and God's dealings with Abraham. In Genesis 15, long before there was a covenant at Sinai, God made a covenant with Abraham pertaining to his offspring in their future land. And in Genesis 15, God was going to give Abraham a vision, and he said in Genesis 15:9 to Abraham, bring me a heifer, 3 years old. That's an example from the herd. A female goat, 3 years old, a ram, 3 years old. Those are examples from the flock. And then a turtle dove and a young pigeon. All Genesis 15:9. And then in verse 10, Abraham brought these, and he began to cut the animals in half, just like you would cut up the animal from the herd, just like you would cut up the animal from the flock. But we're told that in Genesis 15:10, the birds, Abraham did not cut in half. Just as the later Israelites would cut up the animals from the herd and the flock, but not from the birds. And in Genesis 15:7, a smoking fire pot and flaming torch would pass between these pieces. Friends, for the days of Israel, oops, I got rid of it, didn't I? Sorry about that. What it looks like is the burnt offering with the fire and the smoke. That's foreshadowed in Abraham's vision, where the smoke and the flaming torch are going through that. It's as if on the altar, the flaming torch and fire and smoke of God is once more among the offering, just as it was in Abraham's vision. Now, what we see in Genesis 15:17 is a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch. Maybe we could say that's anticipating the altar, where smoke and fire would be. The people of Israel, after all, are the people of Abraham. It makes all the sense in the world that what Abraham was experiencing, they by extension would in some way experience in some similar way of continuity. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the God of Jacob's descendants, the Israelites. In Genesis 15, we saw that scene. Go earlier. In Genesis 8, verse 20, Noah and his family leave the ark with their animals. And the text says, Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So if you're an Israelite and you've come out of slavery from Egypt and God is giving these words to Moses for you from Mount Sinai all of these months and all these weeks minimum here for the book of Leviticus in particular, one of the things you will know from your Genesis record is that we have seen foreshadowings of this kind of thing before. Noah offered burnt offerings to God. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the text says, hello, when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, he said, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of every man's heart is evil from his youth. Never will I again strike down every living thing or creature as I have done. So those are examples from Genesis about offering animals. Let's think about Isaac for a moment. Oh, in Genesis 22, verse 2, God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, whom you love, go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will show you. So the Israelites are going to be getting these stories of Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, knowing what's come before them and the instructions of their own practices. And they're seeing Abraham being told to offer a burnt offering. What did that look like? In Genesis 22, 3, Abraham saddled his donkey, took two young men and went with Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place God told him. And in verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the offering, put it on Isaac his son, took in his hand the fire and the knife, and they began the journey up the mountain. And Isaac said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? And in verses 9 and 10, Abraham built the altar, laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son on top. And then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. Not an animal from the herd, not an animal from the flock, not a bird, his son whom he loved. But God intervened, didn't he? An angel says, don't lay a hand on the boy. And in Genesis 22, 13, an animal from the flock was given, a ram offered for a burnt offering. And Jesus is the true and greater Isaac. And Jesus is the true and greater burnt offering. He was fastened to the wood. And he laid down his life for us on the cross. In Ephesians 5, 2, Paul says, Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. The book of Hebrews is clear that in Hebrews 10, 4, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats, from animals from the herd and the flocks, to take away sins. In Hebrews 10, 12 through 14, when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those being sacrificed. So these individual Israelites have the instructions for bringing their own burnt offerings. And every morning and evening, the priests would be offering burnt offerings for the nation. And then all of a sudden, the relevance and application and practice of the burnt offerings comes to a consummation and a fulfillment with the death of Jesus, a true and greater Isaac, and no ram was offered in his place. He was the fulfillment of all of the burnt offerings. In fact, we're told in Hebrews 1 verse 3 that after he made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. How did Jesus get there? Because Jesus is the ascension offering, y'all. He is. Not only was he fastened to the wood, he entered the heavenly places on our behalf. He was consumed in our place, glorified by resurrection from the dead, and he ascended like a good burnt offering would to the right hand of God as a pleasing, fragrant sacrifice. Luke tells us in Luke 24, 51, Jesus blessed them and parted from them and was carried up into heaven. Jesus is the ascension offering we needed. He has completed all of that atoning work, and God is most pleased. In fact, the Father spoke these words about the Son at the baptism and at the transfiguration, that you would listen to my Son, with whom I am well pleased. Now, in my union with Christ, and in your union with Christ through faith, what's true for him is true for us. He is our perfect sacrifice, and we are not offering burnt offerings. Christ has been offered for us, and so we're trusting in that atoning work. But just as he has made atonement in which I have taken and received by faith, I am also seated with him spiritually where he is. I have already ascended in my union with Christ. I am seated with him in the heavenly places, Paul says. In Colossians 3, we hear these words, "If you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God." He tells us, you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God now. So in the offering of Christ Jesus, a true and greater Isaac, and the true and final burnt offering, we have died with him, we have been buried with him, we have been raised with him, and spiritually we are seated with him in the heavenly places. The death of Christ has satisfied the justice of God. And so in Christ, we offer ourselves up in response to Christ's atoning work, not in any way to complete it. So here's what it sounds like in the sacrificial language of Romans 12. Paul says in Romans 12, verse 1, "I appeal to you, brothers, therefore, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." And so our life is lived out this way. Our life is lived in response to mercy, in response to God's burnt offering in Christ Jesus, providing for us a full measure of atoning work on the cross and through Christ, our greater Isaac. Not only has the death of Christ satisfied the justice of God, the death of Christ is what we look back to as that new covenant work established for us, fulfilling what Jeremiah had promised. So the pattern in Leviticus 1 is fulfilled by Christ in his new covenant work on the cross, and we share in that work through faith. And what he has accomplished is counted to me, so that now when God looks at me, he sees me in Christ Jesus. And I am not condemned, because Christ is the unblemished Son of God, and I am viewed by God as not condemned and without blemish, dressed in righteousness of Christ alone.